Is it text 33? That means there wasn't another verse, though.
Sabarya saprajat kaman. Bubuje va. Bubuje nya viroditaha. Sangiyamana sakirti. Sastrivi suragayakai. Pratyushvesh anubaddena. Vida shrinvan harik katam. Harik kataha. Sabarya saprajat kaman. Bhubuje nya virodataha. Sangiyamana satkirti. Sastribi suragayakai. Pratyushvesh anubhadhena. Vida shrinvan harik kata. Sabarya, along with his wife. Saprajaha, along with his subjects. Kama, the necessities of life. Bhubuje, he enjoyed. Anya, from others. Avirodataha, without disturbance. Samyamana, being praised. Satkirtihi, reputation for pious activities. Sastribihi, along with their wives. Suragayakahi, by celestial musicians. Pati Usheshu, at every dawn. Anubhadhena, being attached. Krida, with the heart. Shrinvan, listening to. Hare, of Lord Hari. Kataha, the topics. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Emperor Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed life with his wife and subjects and fulfilled his desires without being disturbed by unwanted principles contrary to the principles of religion, or rather contrary to the process of religion. Celestial musicians and their wives sung in chorus about the pure reputation of the emperor. And early in the morning every day, he used to listen to the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a loving heart. Purport. Human society is actually meant for realization of perfection in Krishna consciousness. There is no restriction against living with a wife and children, but life should be so conducted that one may not go against the principles of religion, economic development, regulated sense enjoyment, and ultimately liberation from material enjoyment, existence. The Vedic principles are designed in such a way that the conditioned souls who have come to this material existence may be guided in fulfilling their material desires and at the same time be liberated and go back to Godhead, back home. It is understood that Emperor Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed his household life by following these principles. It is said here that early in the morning, there were musicians who used to sing with musical instruments about the glories of the Lord. And the emperor with his family personally used to hear about the pastimes of the Supreme Person. This custom is still prevalent in India, in some of the royal families and temples. Professional musicians sing with shamais, and the sleeping members of the house gradually get up from their beds in a pleasing atmosphere. During bedtime also, the singers sing psalms in relationship with the pastimes of the Lord, with shamai accompaniment, and the householders gradually fall asleep remembering the glories of the Lord in every house. In addition to the singing program, there is an arrangement for Bhagavatam lectures in the evening. Family members sit down, hold Hare Krishna Kirtana, hear narrations from Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and enjoy music before going to bed. The atmosphere created by this Sankirtana movement lives in their hearts, and while sleeping, they also dream of the singing and glorification of the Lord. In such a way, perfection of Krishna consciousness can be attained. This practice is very old. As learned from this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, millions of years ago, Swayambhuva Manu used to avail himself of this opportunity to live a householder life in the peace and prosperity of a Krishna conscious atmosphere. As far as temples are concerned, in each and every royal palace or rich man's house, inevitably there is a nice temple, and the members of the household rise early in the morning and go to the temple to see the Mangal Aratrika ceremony. The Mangal Aratrika ceremony is the first worship of the morning. In the Aratrika ceremony, a light is offered in circles before the deities, as are a conch shell and flowers and a fan. The Lord is supposed to rise early in the morning and take some light refreshment and give audience to the devotees. The devotees then go back to the house or sing the glories of the Lord in the temple. The early morning ceremony still takes place in Indian temples and palaces. Temples are meant for the assembly of the general public. Temples within palaces are specially for the royal families. But in many of these palace temples, the public is also allowed to visit. The temple of the king of Jaipur is situated within the palace. But the public is allowed to assemble. If one goes there, you will see that the temple is always crowded with at least 500 devotees. After the Mangal Aratrika ceremony, they sit down together and sing the glories of the Lord with musical instruments and thus enjoy life. Temple worship by the royal family is also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, where it is stated that those who fail to achieve success in the bhakti yoga principles within one life are given a chance to take birth in the next life in a family of rich men, or in a royal family, or family of learned brahmanas or devotees. If one gets the opportunity to take birth in these families, he can achieve the facilities of a Krishna-conscious atmosphere without difficulty. A child born in that Krishna-conscious atmosphere is sure to develop Krishna consciousness. The perfection which he fails to attain in the last life is again offered in this life, and he can make himself perfect without fail. So this is discussing how those who are more or less entangled in material life can become perfect anyway, not by some personal process, which would require them leaving their families and taking sannyas anyway. According to the Advaitavad sadhana, you have to leave home. You have to take sannyas, otherwise you cannot hope for mukti. They even argue that Arjuna was not fit for mukti because he was a grihastha.
and a kshatriya. And therefore Krishna spoke to him about karma yoga, because he didn't have the adhikara for real jnana, even for jnana. Arjuna, you know, you read this in the commentaries of Shankaracharya on the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna, you don't have the, you're not fit to be trained up in jnana yoga, so I'll give you instructions in karma yoga. But this is not true. What is it? Yepi su papa yonaya. Mami parta vyapashritya. Yepi su papa yonaya. Shriyo vaishastata shudras tepi yanti param gatim. Even those who are the most unfortunate in their birth, and he specifies women, shudras, vaishyas, these are the lower classes, the less fortunate. They can also go to the supreme destination if they take shelter of me. So Swayambhu Vamanu did this. He did it wonderfully. And he did it simply by molding his home environment in a Krishna conscious way. Particularly because every day early in the morning he gave rapt attention to Krishna Katha. Not just some professional reciter of Bhagavatam, but he heard Bhagavatam from pure devotees. Otherwise, no use would have been accomplished. No good would have been accomplished. If he had been listening to some paid man who just does it as a business. But he heard from devotees who actually are attached to the pure devotees, of the, to the pure service of the Lord, and therefore the same attraction was awakened in his heart. The words of Bhagavatam are pure, but you must hear them from a devotee. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught this lesson when this poet came and wanted to present a play that he had written, or a poem. Surup Damodar was very careful not to expose Lord Chaitanya to bad poetry. Not only because it's aesthetically unpleasing, but it's offensive to the Supreme Lord. In transcendental and devotional poetry, you must observe the rules of rasa. You must, everything must be composed properly so that it does not conflict with the real moods of devotion. Rasa basa, inappropriate sentiments expressed, will spoil the whole thing. Particularly the poet must be self-realized. He must be Krishna conscious. Otherwise, how can he inspire Krishna consciousness in his audience? So this poet wasn't maturely Krishna conscious. He was a neophyte. And he wanted Lord Chaitanya to see his poem. Somehow he got in through, I think, Gadadhar Pandit. Lord Chaitanya looked at his poem. No, it was Surup Damodar. Lord Chaitanya didn't see it. Surup Damodar himself looked at the poem and saw in the very first verse, the Mangalacharana, a serious fault that you're saying in your verse that Jagannath is just wood, and now he's come alive as Lord Chaitanya. How can you say that Jagannath is a dead piece of wood? This is a serious aparad. You'll go to hell for this. You want to show this to Lord Chaitanya? So he cursed the pundit to go to hell. And the man, terrified, fell at the feet of Surup Damodar and begged for forgiveness. And how could he correct himself? And Surup Damodar told him, you have to study Bhagavatam properly. Bhara Bhagavat Shastra Bhagavat Pade. At the feet of a real Bhagavat, learn the Bhagavatam. Don't just study it from mundaners, from dry philosophers, or hear it from men who recite Bhagavatam as a business, just to make money and gain a material position, reputation. That hearing is offensive. So Swayambhu Vamanu, although it's not specified, but we can be sure that he heard from sincere devotees. He didn't hear from the materialistic people. Pibita Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Muhuraho Rasika Bhuvi Bhavukaha. This is the injunction. This is Sutta Goswami speaking, Shonaka Rishi's. That's the very beginning of the Bhagavatam. So it's Vyasadeva himself speaking. So, although the Vedas have no author, still Vyasadeva, he has great qualification as the editor of the Vedas. He can also give injunctions. He can also give us instructions that we should follow if we want success in life. His injunction, his recommendation is, drink this nectar of the Bhagavatam. Your whole life, even after you get liberation, don't stop. And who should do it? Rasika, Bhuvi Bhavukaha, those men on the earth who have a taste and have attraction to Krishna. Their business, their prime business in life should be to savor the nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam. So we should hear from such people. Srila Rupa Goswami also says that. Recommending the hearing of Bhagavatam, he specifies, Srimad Bhagavata Artanam Aswaro Rasikaisaha. We should relish, enjoy, carefully taste Srimad Bhagavatam. The messages, the artas, the Bhagavatam is not just nice songs. There's a message. There are messages that we have to understand, not just hear the melodies and the poetry. But we should understand the teachings of the Bhagavatam in the association of Rasika Bhaktas, not in some university class where the professor is applying the critical techniques to dissect the poetry and demythologize it. Not hearing from professional men who simply are putting on some cheap entertainment to make some money in the name of Bhagavad Saptaha. But in an association of devotees who actually have a real honest taste for it. They're reciting not for money, but as service. It's their service and it's their life. So that, the devotees in ISKCON and a few other spiritual organizations in India, they're serving the Bhagavatam, not using it for their selfish purposes. One incident, my wife was talking to one of the neighbors here in town. I was in Delhi, and the neighbor asked, "Where's your husband?" She said, "He's gone to give Bhagavat Pravachan in Delhi." And so the neighbor, I already told this before, the neighbor said, "Well, how much are they paying him?" I went to give class in the ISKCON temple in Delhi. And she said, "No, they don't pay him anything." And she was incredulous. The neighbor could not believe. The lady said, "It's impossible. All the pundits speak the Bhagavatam and get paid for it. Otherwise, they don't do it." She said, "At least they must be giving him some nice clothes or feeding him nice." And I said, no, it's just service. But it could not be understood in the modern culture. You don't do that. Bhagavatam is just a business. That hearing from a businessman doesn't, a man who's making a business out of the Bhagavatam, is useless. Swayambhu Manu was also a man of the world, but he didn't use the Bhagavatam for material purposes. He stopped his business for 1 hour a day in the morning and heard from Bhagavatam as a devotee. Pratapa Rudra Maharaj was the king of Orissa, Gajapati. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refused to meet him because he was the king. As a strict sannyasi, he considered it that it would ruin his reputation and people would laugh at him if he met with the king. He refused. But Pratapa Rudra eventually got to the personal mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu during the Ratha Yatra festival. Lord Chaitanya was in one of the gardens on the Yatra Marga, taking rest after the day's procession. And Pratapa Rudra Maharaj, he was advised by Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, "You dress up like a devotee and appear. You put on simple dress of a devotee. Take off your royal garbs.
and come to Lord Chaitanya while he's resting in the garden. Massage his feet. And he'll accept you. He did. But Bhattabharuja Maharaj, he recited one verse of the Bhavatam while he was massaging Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's feet. Tavakatam ritam tapta jivanam kavibhiriditam what is it? Kalma shapaham. What is it again? Shravanam arladam shri madatatam uvi gvinanti ye buridajana. Sung by the gopis in their ecstasy of separation from Krishna during the rasa dance when Krishna left them. They were looking everywhere for Krishna and talking to the trees and the birds and the animals, asking where they could find Krishna. And their realization that they speak in this verse is that, Krishna, we don't have you now, we've lost you. But we're burning like the materialists in the fire of separation. But Tavakatamritam, the nectar of topics about you, give life back to those who are burning in the fire of material life. They're all auspicious. The greatest poets sing them. Just hearing them is the greatest act of auspiciousness. Those men who selflessly engage themselves in spreading the glories of Srimad, of your topics, especially in the reciting of Srimad Bhagavatam without material motive, they are the most, Prabhupada translates, the most munificent welfare workers. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu responded to this idea. Yes, you are the most munificent welfare worker. And he embraced Pratapa Rudra Maharaj. In his trance, he didn't know who this was who had recited the verse. If he had known, he probably would have run away. That's the idea of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of Krishna. Yaidam para, Krishna says in the Gita, Yaidam paramam guyam mad bhakteshwabhidasyati. He who helps the devotees by reciting this knowledge of the Gita to them, teaching them my messages of the Gita, bhaktim paramai kritva mame vaishatya samshayaha. He's doing the highest variety of service to me, devotional service. And it's guaranteed he will come back to me. Nacha tasmad manushyeshu kaschin me priyakritamaha bhavita nacha me tasmad anyak priyaturo bhuvi. There's no one more dear to me than him in the whole world, and never there never will be anybody more dear. And that's simply the devotee who dedicates himself to the message, to the mission of teaching, of preaching the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the purpose of ISKCON that Prabhupada established us, this society for, is the propagation of the teachings of the Gita and the Bhagavatam, and the chanting of Krishna's names in the association of devotees. Whether we're speaking or hearing, it's the most auspicious process, and we'll, no matter what else we are, it will perfect our lives. Hare Krishna, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
Could you explain a little more about this, rasa that governs the production of poetry?
Oh, that's a big topic. According to Kavi Karnapur, who wrote a textbook on how to write and how to understand poetry, he talked about what is the essence of poetry. Or using the analogy of a body, the Kavi Purusha, Kavya Purusha, the, just like you see on the Parikram mark, these effigies of Giriraj, a man laying on the ground with his arms and legs splayed out, so that personification of Giriraj as an effigy, a body. So like that, you can think of the body of poetry, and you try to identify the different parts and find the soul. So Kavi Karnapur says the soul of poetry is rasa. That's what poetry exists for. Real poetry is to evoke in the heart of the living being who hears it the mellows of transcendental devotional exchanges. Rasa.
Jai Shri Krishna Balaram. Poetry that doesn't do that isn't real poetry. Poetry should be devotional. But how do you do it? And this is all science about how rasa is evoked. You can't just say rasa or the names of the rasa. That doesn't work, just naming them. You have to subtly evoke them. You cannot express these super mundane feelings directly in words. You have to subtly evoke a sense of them. And so that's done by various poetic devices, by subtle suggestions, not by saying things directly. You know, just the word bhava will not evoke bhava. You have to have bhava and use the words very poetically in such a way that the bhava awakes in the hearer. You know, the person who doesn't have the bhava, no matter what he says, it won't evoke anything good in the reader, anything spiritual. Anyway, there's a whole textbook that explains how it's done for the benefit of those who want to write poetry and those who want to read it. It's a whole science. But the soul of poetry is rasa. The prana, the vital air. Chai Shri Gurni Tai is what's called dwani, or suggestion. The power of words to say more than what they literally mean. Words have their literal meaning. In scientific textbooks, there's no attempt to be poetic. The words mean what they say in the dictionary, and you don't play games with them. But in poetry, the poet plays with words and tries to get more meaning out of them than what they say literally. You can have metaphorical meaning, when a word can't mean what it normally means literally, so therefore there's a extended meaning. For example, Gangayam Goshaha. So you say there's a Gosha, a cowherd village, on the Ganga. That's not possible. You don't have villages on top of the water. So you have to understand that poetically or metaphorically, that it doesn't mean literally on the water, it means on the shore that's next to the water. That's the what's called Lakshana, or indirect or metaphorical reference. On the Ganga means next to the Ganga. But there's more to it. The words don't stop there. There's a purpose for using that metaphor. Otherwise, you're just, you know, making words difficult, fancy use of words just to strain the brain of the readers. But there's a purpose to it. This is called Prayojanavati Lakshana, Lakshana that has another purpose. It's to suggest something. The Ganga, the water is cool, and there are nice breezes, and it's sanctified. It's a holy river, most holy river. So to say that the village is on the Ganga, meaning on the shore of the Ganga, suggests, without saying it, the coolness of the atmosphere, the breezes, and the sanctity of it, of the atmosphere. Not said. All we said was there's a Gosha, a cowherd village on the Ganga. But there's a power of suggestion in the poet's words. He evokes that feeling or deeper understanding. It can be an idea, or it can be a rasa, a feeling, or a poetic a poetic device that's suggested. Various things can be suggested, but that power of suggestion, that is the life of poetry. Rasa is the soul. Without rasa, the poetry is dead. And the vital air that motivates, moves the body, the prana, is suggestion, dvani. And words and their meanings, they're the physical body, the bones and the muscles. And then a body can be ornamented. The body may be beautiful in its own right, but then you put, you know, jewelry on it to make it more beautiful. So those are the poetic devices, the figures of speech, called alankaras. Yeah. So these are different parts of the body of poetry, but the soul of the body, the soul inhabiting the body, is rasa. Okay. Yeah.
But this dvani only seems to work if you have the same cultural background. Because for many people in the West, yes, it doesn't really evoke sanctity or feeling sanctity or...
Yeah, that would require an act of translation. Someone would have to make it understandable by a foreign audience. The poetry has to be translated, and there has to be some commentary in addition to explain the culture. That's what Prabhupada does in his purports. You know, he's translating books that are textbooks, but in part it's poetry. The Bhagavatam is full of poetry. So Prabhupada's poetry, his purports, is not only explaining the philosophy, but he's explaining the poetic aspects of the Bhagavatam and the other books he writes purports on also. Explaining to us, Prabhupada takes great pains to explain the Bhagavatam culture, the Vedic culture to us. Because without understanding it, we don't know what's really behind the literal meaning of the words. We can translate it from a dictionary, but we only get a vague idea of the real sense of it, unless we know the atmosphere in which it was written, the world in which it was written, as you say, the culture. So if the readers don't know it, then the presenter, the translator, has to give them additional information to fill them in on what they don't know. Prabhupada has done that very expertly. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna. Anything else?
Yes. Manu, capital mentioned here,
Vaishnavi.
Where is it?
It's in Brahmavarta.
Where is the
Brahmavarta? Brahmavarta is, Hare Krishna. It's the part of northern India between the Aryavarta, between the Vindhya and the Himalaya, is Aryavarta. Brahmavarta is a part of Aryavarta. In Aryavarta is where Brahman has performed sacrifice, at least originally, in ancient times. It's been spread since then to all over India, but originally only in that part of India. And the part that's mostly in the Punjab is the most sanctified part. That's Brahmavarta. The original center of Vedic culture is in the Punjab. Punjab, and maybe extending out a little bit into parts of, I guess, whatever is next to Punjab over there, Haryana, whatever. That region is Brahmavarta, on the earth. So Varhishmati is the capital of that Brahmavarta, the first kingdom on the earth, earliest kingdom. But there's also a Varhishmati on one of the peaks, I think, surrounding Meru Mountain, above Swargaloka. Brahma has his planet in the middle, and then various devatas have their planets. I think Manu has his Parishmati up there, too.
Yeah.
And a mountain up in the heavenly planets. That's a different Parishmati, the original one. But the one on the earth is probably in the Punjab. Anybody here Punjabi?
No.
Okay. The poets, when they talk about metaphors, Jiva Goswami and Kavi Karmapura repeat this metaphor. Gar Vahika. That Vahika is just a bull. It's a bull. That's a metaphor. He's not a bull, but he's so stupid that he's like a bull. So Vahika means Punjabi. If you look it up in the dictionary. So in modern times, the idea of what to be Punjabi has changed a little bit. But originally, it was the center of Vedic culture was between those five rivers. That's now the Punjab. Punjab means five holy rivers. Okay, Sutlej, Sutlej, the Jhelum, the three other rivers are up there. Ooh, I don't know if they're there. Saraswati may bend them on Ganga. It gets up there. The Ganga doesn't go to Punjab.
Ganga is not.
Yeah, because it goes up to.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Ganga. Well, Ganga has four different currents.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lakananda comes through Badrinath. Maybe some other part of the Ganga goes down through Punjab. I don't know.
Yeah.
Another branch of the
Ganga.
Which?
Sindhu.
Sindhu is one of the five rivers too, yeah. It is. Yeah, five. There are five there, yeah. Mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Okay, so we can stop here. Thank you, all glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.